Hello once again, faithful listener, and welcome to this, the Small Voice podcast for the merry month of December. Our Christmas special, if you will, given that no one really does specials for Advent. But whether you're hanging up that stocking on the wall or hoping that the snow is indeed about to fall, why not take a break and settle in with a nice cup of hot chocolate for the next hour or so in the company of Margaret,
hello,
Anne,
hello,
and me, Darren. We'll even bring the marshmallows. So, what's on Santa's list for this show, I hear you ask? Well, we have the usual features of 1,000 words and the moral mixdown, plus an exclusive in the form of some very special live music from the Chris Amer Trio playing some cool jazz for Yule. On top of this, we have a couple of special features. The team will be giving you some recommendations for Christmas presents, and we'll be looking ahead to the launch of something we're grandly calling Small Voice of the Month. Jings, this is even better than a selection box. So, quick health check on the team. It's our Heaven and Hell feature. Margaret, how's the month been, the week, the hour? You pick, you choose. Heaven and Hell. Heaven or Hell?
Well, I was going to pick yesterday morning, in fact, because I looked out very early, kind of opened the curtains sometime after 6 o'clock and thought, I wonder what the weather's like. And it didn't look too bad. And I thought, oh, maybe I could go out for a run. And then I opened the door and I heard the rain battering down and thought, right, that's it. I'm going nowhere. Until, of course, I had to go out later on. And I think that's it. And, of course, by lunchtime, the sun was shining. And I thought, well, maybe I could have done something after all. And that's a bit like my life, really. It's up and down.
I was going to say, for our international listeners, if ever you've looked online at pictures of Scotland and thought, wow, it looks beautiful, you know, there's a cost in being this lush and green, we have to say.
Absolutely,
this,
yes. But
this past month has been pretty wet.
It's been very, very variable, I have to say. As people frequently say, you got all the seasons in one day and all different kinds of weather.
And if you don't like the weather, hang on half an hour in Scotland, that's what they say. Okay, Anne, our listeners are well aware it's not heaven or hell, it's heaven and hell. So,
well, just to shock you, it's been pretty hellish this last month.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I think it's a combination of world events, which I think everyone would agree is pretty close to hell, plus personal challenges. So it's been a difficult month. And I've been very aware in myself for the first time ever of a temptation to escape into a kind of Victorian view of Christmas, you know, something quite unreal and quite unhealthy, I think, really, as a way of escaping from it. I was choosing images for the December issue of our church magazine last week, and I came across this painting of a village, and it's a snow scene. And there's golden light in the window of every cottage in the village. And right at the centre, there's a wee church and it's got a beautiful Christmas tree with fairy lights outside. And I wanted to go into the picture and escape. And I know it's wrong. I know that for every person, you know, toasty inside their cottage, there are 10 outside in the cold. And therefore, I should not want to be a part of this. So I just said, get thee behind me, Santa, and carried on with real life, no matter how challenging.
Oh, wow. Okay. My heaven and hell, there's been definite aspects of heaven. I turned 50 last month, yay, regular listeners may recall, and some very good friends of mine bought me some Amarone, which is an Italian wine, which I'd never tasted before. But I knew that the former Bishop of Edinburgh, Richard Holloway, is a big fan.
Indeed.
How would I know that, Anne? And so I thought, well, I'll give this a go. But of course, I didn't think that. Friends thought it for me. And it was heavenly, I have to say. Mm-hmm. Absolutely heavenly. But obviously, anyone who's listening, we strongly discourage you from drinking and listening to our show at the same time. Also, it's heavenly because you got Strictly On and Doctor Who at the same time.
That's true.
But if I can do a gear change that's worthy of Alex Jones, bless her, on The One Show, where she has to go from light to dark. I'm with you, Anne, just now in terms of world events. And we can't ignore that we're recording this on a Thursday. And yesterday, the UK Parliament voted to approve and allow RAF bombing raids on Syria. I don't know if I'm in hell over that or purgatory, because there's a lot of certainty around in the response. There's a lot of certainty from those calling for bombing and those calling against it. And I have to admit, I'm just adrift in a sea of hang me just now.
Indeed.
Somewhere in the middle, wondering, saying, I do not know. And if anyone's expecting us to take a punt at that in our moral mixdown later on in the show, I'll tell you now that we're not. And maybe that's my fault. I just think, you know, Can I just pass on this exam question?
I just felt so relieved that I wasn't an MP having to vote on it and having to carry in my conscience for the rest of my life what I voted for.
Yeah.
I think maybe you have to have a certain mindset to be able to make those kind of decisions. And that's why none of us, I guess, are MPs or parliamentarians of any colour, really, that we would find it, I certainly would find it difficult to make the decisions.
Yeah.
But not everybody does. Somebody's got to draw the hard lines.
I guess we've got to be thankful in an odd sort of strange way. And now another gear shift onto other things. At time of recording, it's 21 shopping days until Christmas, or to put it another way, 21 days until Christmas. It may be that you are incredibly organised and have already bought all your presents, but probably you're more like me in that you haven't even started. Well, fear ye not. To save you that Christmas Eve dash to the all-night garage, here at Small Voice, we've been working hard to come up with suggestions for loved ones far and near. Before I continue my job as a radio DJ, Margaret, what would your choice be for Christmas presents then? What advice do you have to give our listeners?
Well, I suppose the essence of giving a present is that there is somebody who's going to receive it. So your kind of first priority, I would always say, is to think of the recipient and what is going to suit that person. I'm not in favour of buying mass presents and then sort of dishing them out to all on Sunday. Sometimes the choice might be a bit bizarre, I think. But I had some opportunities. My hairdresser was having a special evening where you could go and have a glass or two of something sparkly, and you could look at some sparkly things and you could try out various treatments and so on. And they also had various clothing items on sale, and I went with one of my daughters, which was a good move because she said, "Oh, I really like that." And I said, "All right, how about that for your Christmas present?" "Well, okay." So that was a good move, I think, is to go out with somebody and say, "No, do you like this? Is that kind of all right? Do you think that would do?" My other daughter was having an online body shop party and then kind of texted around and said, "Is there anything you want to order?" And her father said, "No, don't think so." And I sort of texted back and said, "But surely, dear." However, I don't think he took it up. But all sorts of different things. I think one of the presents I was very happy with last year that I got was for my young granddaughter, because I got her a tiger. And I had seen this in one of these flyers, you know, you can pay a sum of money every month and you are paying to keep a tiger alive, I think, basically. So we've been doing that, and she gets updates on said. It's not actually, one individual tiger. I think it's a sort of generic tiger that she gets information on. But it's just wonderful because she loves tigers. So I haven't decided yet whether to add a snow leopard or something else to that, or go for something different. But I think, yeah, find something that suits the recipient, whether it's an actual item or whether it's a virtual thing. And
I thought you were going to say with your daughter that you did the, "Oh, that's quite nice. Do you think that's quite nice?" And then try and do the, and then dash and buy, you know, buy the present and then hope that they don't buy it for themselves. But you were up front and said, "How about that for Christmas?"
Well, the other side of it was that she said, "Now, is there anything you would quite like, Mark? How about this?" "Oh, yeah, that's quite nice." Okay, right.
It's quite grown up, isn't it? You know, it's a long way from buying the stuff and hiding it in the wardrobe, isn't it? You've come a long way.
Yes, I think we're a long way from that. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, Anne, what about you?
Well, I found a couple of Christian-themed gifts and then what I think is a genuinely Christian gift. The first is St Anthony's golf balls. And the advert goes like this. "Ever been on a golf course where you spend more time searching in the rough for a stray golf ball than actually enjoying the game? If so, it may be time to invest in the friendly gift of St Anthony-inspired golf balls for your friend and family. St Anthony is the patron saint of lost objects and missing things. So as you prowl the golf course, you may just be able to find your golf ball that little bit sooner with the help of St Anthony. $10.95 online. Or how about this? Holy smokes, fragrance fire lighters? No, not at all. Having a warm fire is the perfect way to gather family and friends for a time of fun and merriment during the busy Christmas season. This year, you can get your fire started faster and stronger with Holy Smokes fire lighters. Holy Smokes fire lighters are made of 100% recycled materials, including, folks, melted wax from church candles and recycled wood fibres to create a pleasant aroma to fill your home during the Christmas celebrations. Holy Smokes fire lighters proclaim that they are 30% Lutheran, 30% Catholic and 40% other, making Holy Smokes a truly ecumenical blend, and all for only $6.95 for one pack.
I'm signing up for that.
Yeah.
And your serious one.
But my serious one. Almost 10 years ago, amongst our closest family, we decided, look, the adults don't need anything. By far the best thing to do is to give a virtual gift. So it was just when Present Aid was getting started for Christian Aid. And I think the very first gift was a goat, I think, was the very first one advertised. And it just seems a no-brainer, you know, £9 buys school books and bags and biros for a child in Bangladesh, or £18 buys a floating garden that can withstand floods in Bangladesh and keep a family's harvest safe. So it would be madness not to do this. It needn't be Christian Aid. There are loads of other, you know, organisations do it, like Leprosy Mission has Gifts for Life, and there's all sorts. And that really is at the heart of our gift giving now in the family.
Okay. Well, time for mine. And my suggestion, actually, a little bit, not quite up there with the holy golf balls, but I'm actually going to let you listen to it first and then we'll talk about it. Now, you may know your stuff. I know Anne does. She's almost singing along here. This is Locus Isti by Anton Bruckner, and it's from a CD of motets. Now, it's a motet of Brahms and Bruckner. Interestingly, I think Bruckner was intensely religious and Brahms intensely wasn't. So that's quite something there. It's a CD by Tenebrae, conducted by Nigel Short, available from Signum Classics. Only just been released. And it's a beautiful CD, but I think the CD is partly in memory of Tenbury's co-founder, Barbara Pollock, because part of the proceeds go to Macmillan Cancer Research. So I kind of picked that because I thought it was sort of in the line of the, not quite ethical giving, but, you know, giving something but having a little charitable input there as well. But this actually brings me on to a point about the ethical giving, because I thought, oh, that's quite clever. And then I thought, how do you let the person know? Because, you know, obviously when you do the ethical gift, the person knows that you bought them a goat or whatever. And I was just thinking about this, you know, if there's a label on it, you know, do you peel the label off if it's on the wrapper? Blast. Peel it off and stick it on, or do you write in the card, by the way, some of this money went to my Macmillan Cancer, just in case you think I'm just bought you a CD? I don't know if you've got any advice.
Silence.
I would put it on the card.
Or just say, no, I don't care. I just, it's that.
Oh, and it just is.
There is that aspect I sometimes think of the ethical giving, and that, you know, I just know that if I was a kid, and I was bought a goat. Oh, dear. Put it that way. If I was a child, I'd be going, oh, can I not get some chocolate? But, you know, at the same time, I guess if the animals thing is quite neat, Marv, that you mentioned, because I think with the tiger, they get a soft tiger, don't they?
Yes, there's a little cuddly tiger as well. Really, that's good. Yeah.
So, look, ideas from get along to your hairdresser, apparently, to weird and wacky. Those would be, I mean, I can think of loads of people who would enjoy waking up to St. Anthony's golf balls.
You bet.
Including round the stable, to music, to the tried and tested, ethical gifting, I don't know. And of course, places like Oxfam as well do that, and basically go online. There's loads and plenty time before Christmas, I'm sure, folks. Now, we are delighted to be joined by some very special musical guests in the studio. I'm going to introduce them individually and they can say hello, first of all. So we have Chris Amer, who's going to be playing guitar. Chris, hello.
Good evening.
And Conal McDonough on whistle.
Hello.
And Neil Payton on percussion. Hello. And collectively, I believe, we decided a few minutes ago, you are known as the Chris Amer Trio because this is the first time that you've officially played together. Would that be right?
The first time we've ever played together.
I was going to say your first paying gig, but I've got news for you on that front. So how did it come about? You're all at, or have been at, the conservatoire in Glasgow, is that correct?
Yes. I was asked to play some jazz guitar for this podcast.
Yes, I should say, Chris, because you were you came in almost a year ago now or something?
Something like
that. And you played with Grace Walker, on flute, and you played guitar at the time.
I did. I was racking my brains. I didn't know what I would do. I don't really play guitar on its own. I kind of have to play with other folk at the same time. So I just asked to, first and foremost, probably good friends, but also I love their playing. So I just thought we'd blend well together. I thought we'd have a nice time, make some nice sounds.
Are you buying that, Connell, or is it just because he's your flatmate, you reckon?
I just think he wants me to make him a curry later on.
Okay. And Neil, you're the one who has left the conservatoire, that's right? So you're out in the big bad world now.
Yeah,
how's that going?
The big bad world. It's been all right. Sort of strange spending 4 years very intensively studying jazz and then ending up not playing very much of it and doing lots of ceilidhs and sort of weddings and stuff like that. But it's a treat to play jazz, especially with Chris. His compositions are very nice.
Oh,
I'm a fan.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wish we had kind of webcam here because you are sat behind a drum kit, and I know it's not your full drum kit, but this is the first time I think in Small Voice that we've had full blown drummage. So we're very excited about that. And I have to say as well, the first time that we have had proper or anything like proper jazz, I would say.
Yeah.
And are you happy with that as a description of the style, gents? Are we jazz? Are we jazz folk? Are we folk jazz?
Jazz
could a
is
fight ensue?
Fine. Yeah, that'll do.
So, Chris, do you want to tell us about the first tune? Because you have written the tunes, haven't you?
Yes, so they're both written by me. The first one is probably more a kind of folky trad tune that I just thought would sound nice, sort of played like how you'd play a jazz sort of head, with like playing the melody, soloing, playing around with it. So it's called Hunter's Lodge, and it was written last summer 2014. I was in Orkney at the time and playing on cruise ships, and I wrote this tune just before I went to Aberdeen to stay with the Hunter family of Duthie Terrace, Aberdeen, and on the front of their house they have a sort of novelty plaque that says Hunter's Lodge. So I was thinking for a title for this tune, so I just called it Hunter's Lodge because, I don't know, in my mind they're all kind of around the same time.
So, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Right, so with Chris on guitar, Connell on whistle and Neil on percussion, if we are ready, this is going to be Hunter's Lodge. Thank you. Hunter's Lodge. Chris, I have to ask, you said working on the cruise ships, and I had a picture in my mind, you know, okay, it's a bit, you know, grim in one sense being on a cruise ship, but at the same, you know, at the same time you're on a cruise. But then you said Orkney. Now I remember sailing to Orkney, and I don't think I'm doing a kind of wavy motion with my hands. Was it not a bit rough, or am I exaggerating?
I think it certainly is, but we in fact were on land, and like almost every day a cruise would come to Kirkwall
and stay,
and we'd kind of be there, and the Orkney Islands Council would employ us to entertain all the American, Australian, European, whatever, tourists.
As they came off clutching their
exactly, yes. Uh-huh. So we'd be on the quayside, or sometimes we'd get invited on and to do a wee show. Yeah, it was fun. It was good. Yeah. People were very nice. They appreciated it. So
yeah, it's all experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, listen, thank you for that first track, and we'll get you back later on in the show. So thanks for just now, gents.
You're very welcome.
Time for our Thousand Words feature. So, Anne, what have you got this month?
Well, my guest this month is Ruth Gouldbourne. Ruth grew up in Edinburgh, but she's lived in London since 2006, when she was called to be minister of Bloomsbury Baptist Church on Shaftesbury Avenue. Ruth Church is right at the heart of everything that London has to offer. To the south, there are the West End theatres. To the east are the Inns of Court. And to the west, there's the shopping mecca of Oxford Street and the infamous attractions of Soho. So, Which kind of image did this urban minister choose to talk about?
Well, it's effectively a picture in three layers. So the bottom layer has a row of three couple figures, an angel and a human being wrestling. Each of the angels is in different colours. There's one green, one red, one blue. They're all standing up, but the wrestling looks quite fierce. The middle section is what at first glance might look like a traditional crib scene. It's dominated by the stable, and right in the middle there is the Christ child with his mother leaning over him. There's an ox and an ass. There's Joseph sitting to the side with his head buried in his hands. And then on the outside of the crib, on the right-hand side, are the shepherds, and on the left-hand side are the wise men. But they're really very much outside of the crib scene. There is a path that leads from the wrestling angels at the bottom, sort of winds its way through up to the crib, as if the viewer is being invited to walk through up to the crib, and it actually arrives right at the Christ child. Above the crib, on the roof of the stable, there are three more angels who appear to be holding hands and singing. And then above them, there is a circle of angels who are flying. That they're in a circle, as if they were doing a circle dance, really. Some of them, their faces towards the viewer. Some of them have their backs towards the viewer. The faces are not beautiful. They don't look like conventional angels. They're fairly tough looking. And right across the very top is a banner with wording in Greek, which, unless you know what it says, is wording in Greek. But what it actually talks about is when the painting was made, it was Sandro Botticelli. It's the only painting he ever signed. And this is what he wrote across the top, that he wrote it at the time of great troubles. So it's sort of a Christmas scene, but it's definitely not a conventional one.
It's definitely not a conventional one. So why, when you could have chosen almost any nativity, and there are many glorious nativities out there, did you choose this one?
I first saw it in real life about 2 or 3 years ago in the National Gallery, and I was just bowled over by it. Partly it is the colours. The colours are glorious. They're very bright, they're very clear. I realise since it has recently been cleaned up, which makes it very bright. And the colours just caught me, particularly the colours of the angels in the top layer, just were so beautiful. I stood in front of it thinking, this is amazing, and realised that the more I looked at it, the more weird it was. And it is the weirdness of it that I love. It's full of hidden meaning, and yet, even without the meaning, it's still beautiful, even if you don't understand what's going on. I think it's partly because it's not conventional. It's anything but saccharine. It's anything but easy to look at. It's challenging and difficult, and every time I go to see it, and I go to see quite a lot, it's different. There's something new in it.
You mentioned that this was a painting painted in troubled times. Mm. What kind of trouble was it that Botticelli was dealing with?
Well, Savonarola had been powerful in the city just before he was painting this. Okay. Savonarola was a reformer, a friar, who became very powerful in Florence and was a tremendous preacher, won over all sorts of people, was very much an ascetic, and wanted to call people to a pure way of life and a pure faith that was focused entirely on what he understood to be a life entirely committed to God and free from all distraction of beauty and delight and enjoyment, which probably gives away my my position on it, and possibly was important at a time when things had become overblown or lascivious or dangerously lax, but certainly caused conflict in the city about whether to take what in English terms you call a puritanical route or the more traditional route of the beauty and the richness of the worship and the accoutrements of worship. And Savonarola had had the citizens of Florence burning their jewellery and destroying the paintings and so on. And it's not clear where Botticelli fitted in that. Some of his family were on Savonarola's side, some of them weren't. He's somewhere in the middle. Some of the commentators on the painting argue that he was deeply influenced by him. Others say he's resisting. I have no idea. I'm no art historian. But in the middle of somebody trying to insist on a meaning, he is painting something that is mysterious, I think. And that, I think, really is important at a time when we hear around about us a lot of people insisting on meanings. This is how it has to be. Within our own faith and in all sorts of other faiths and politically. And I reading the painting, who knows what Botticelli's doing, a child is born and that changes the world, but we don't know how. And that mystery and openness seems to be really important, and how we live with that in the face of other people trying to close down possibility.
Now, I'm guessing that as an experienced minister, you've had to preach on Christmas Day a good number of times now.
Yes, we do have to preach on Christmas quite a lot.
How do you find something new to say about the Nativity?
The longer I go on with this, the more bewildered I get by it all. And again, I think this is why this painting is important to me. The owning of bewilderment as not a failure and not something to be solved, but a spiritual grace has become very important to me in the last few years. Not knowing, not understanding, and just noting what is and discovering grace in that, and discovering that in Christmas. This is a birth. That's all you know at the time. Something happens, but we don't know what. And how do we live with the reality of that without trying to impose meaning on it? And I think that's why this painting's been really important. It's got all sorts of meanings, and people write reams and reams about it, I've discovered, and it doesn't matter. It's just the painting that's there, and the being with it and letting it be what it is and speak in the moment seems important. And I think for Christmas, for the Nativity, that's been important. Any birth is mysterious. Who is this child? Who's this child going to be? And the birth of this child probably is more mysterious than most, but were there angels above the crib at the first Christmas? There ought to have been, which is why we get told they're there, but were there? And we don't know, and it would be nice to think they were there because that would make it make sense, but maybe they weren't and maybe it doesn't make sense, but it's okay. That tends to be where I've been the last few years. I've got less and less inclined to give answers the more I've preached. Not less and less sure of there being an answer, but less and less sure that I know it.
Yeah. So I guess you would want to help people to sit with the mystery.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think this picture does that for me. It doesn't yield up its meaning easily. I assume Botticelli knew what he was doing when he painted it, but he painted it for a very specific time in a very specific context. And that isn't my time, my context, but the painting still means something. And I think it's similar with the Christmas story. It fitted in its context. It made sense in its context. Mary and Joseph knew something of what was going on. I'm not Mary and Joseph, and I've got to make some sense of it some other way. Yeah.
OK, Anne, so where do people go to see Botticelli's Mystic Nativity?
Well, if you're in London, you can do what Ruth did and go to the National Gallery and stand in front of it. Or you can go to our website, www.smallvoice.org.uk. And the only other thing I'd want to say is, if you're having a Christmas party, wouldn't you want Ruth there?
Absolutely.
She's just so full of life and everything you'd want for a party.
Absolutely. Regular listeners may recall that last month we had our final Shelf Life feature, where humorist Garrison Keillor won a place on our Small Voice virtual bookshelf of godly goodliness. The shelf was getting pretty full, to be fair. So in place of the Shelf Life feature, next month we're going to launch our new feature called Small Voice of the Month. So, the idea... Margaret, what's the idea?
Well, Darren, as you explained it to me earlier on...
I just felt you should do something.
Yeah, I always...
Well, you're going to be curating this. This is your baby.
So I've been told, yes. I think I wasn't here when the discussion took place, and that's obviously why.
Never miss a meeting.
Yes, well, I think the idea really is to find a small voice who will be a person, I presume, that has perhaps... not featured in a major way. It might be somebody that you know, might be something that you've read somewhere in a newspaper or whatever, but somebody who's made a difference by what they've said, what they've done, and that has turned things around. I can't remember, Darren, you had a wonderful phrase for this earlier on, which
I said,
small
voice, big difference.
That's it, yes. Uh-huh. So that's what it is.
The T-shirt's made up of
it. Yeah, I think that's a brilliant idea, actually. But this is something that we would love all our many, many listeners to contribute to, because if you can suggest a small voice any month, any time that you would like us to give a mention to, then we'll certainly follow that up. It may get to the stage that we have to have some kind of competition for the Small Voice of the Month because we get so many recommendations. That would be great, wouldn't it?
Be fantastic.
Yes. I mean, we talked about this a little while ago and we wondered, you know, I mean, there are the big names out there, you know, there's people who are always going to be in the news. So I hate to break it to Justin Bieber, but he's not going to be Small Voice of the Month for us, you know. But there are also those kind of people who just unexpectedly say or do something which has big implications, big ramifications. And sometimes they're picked up by the media, although often they go unnamed. I mean, the example that I thought of recently was the father of one of the people killed in the attacks in Paris. And he wrote an open letter to the people of ISIS or Daesh, whatever we're calling them. And the line in that was, "You are not going to have my hate."
Yeah.
And that was immensely powerful. And actually, you know what? That sort of was front page news, although in the way it goes, none of us know his name unless we Google it. I don't know if you had any thoughts or examples, Anne. Or...
Well, I mean, one that came to mind, if we've been doing this in the past few months, was the care home in the United States that specialises in care for people with dementia who've installed a bus stop. Because apparently the most common problem is that people in the home want to go home. And usually that leads to some kind of coercion. You know, you have to say to the person, you can't go home. But by installing the bus stop, patients go and sit at the bus stop and wait for a bus. But there is no bus, of course. And a nurse will just go and sit beside them and blether to them at the bus stop. And after a while, they forget that they wanted to go home. And they come back quite happily of their own accord. And there's never any conflict and no coercion. And all it is a poll with the words bus stop written at the top. And it's made such a difference. And it's such a small thing.
Yeah.
But just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been my suggestion.
Yeah, so, as I say, there might be some more obvious ones. And, you know, listen, hey, if the BBC pick it up, that doesn't mean that we can't. But we would like to hear from you. So as Margaret says, it's now very much over to you, our listeners. We'll be recording the next podcast in early January. So you have 4 weeks or so to get in touch with your suggestions for people worthy of our first Small Voice of the Month award. Remember, you can leave a comment on our website, smallvoice.org.uk, or you can tweet us at @small_voice1. We'd love to hear from you. We're delighted to welcome back Chris, Connell and Neil, the Chris Amer Trio, as they're known, we have decided. Welcome back, gents.
Hello.
Can I just check, though? I mean, Chris Amer Trio, that could be C-A-T. I mean, you know, there was, I'm showing my jazz credentials here, the Esbjørn Svensson Trio,
yeah.
E-S-T. Are we thinking abbreviating already?
Oh, C-A-T. I don't know.
Some Moody album covers?
Maybe down the line. I don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't given it a lot of thought.
Yeah.
We'll just see. Who knows?
Now, before... you play, we do normally ask some questions of our musicians, and normally we run through 5 questions, but Chris, you've done this bit already, you may have forgotten, so we're going to abbreviate, concatenate it a little bit. I've given up asking young people what they want played at their funeral, it's ridiculous. Judging by the response I just got from Connell there, you see, like, what? So we're not going to do that, but you can join in with us if you want, Chris, or you can contradict what you said earlier. But guys, this is about your musical life. So first single that you downloaded or listened to, what would that be? I can't remember what yours was, Chris. Do you remember?
I think it was a song called Joanna by a band called Little Comets from Newcastle. I didn't actually like music until... well into my teens, so
there you go.
It's quite I didn't really see. Oh yeah, I never really bought music before then, so it's a fairly recent one.
Yeah, and Connell, do you remember?
I do. I think the first album I bought was a Sex Pistols album, actually, the yellow one.
Never mind the bollocks.
That's the one. Yeah.
I don't know. They may have to beep that. I'm just going to say bollocks again so that they can beep it a third time. If we all do it at the same time, 1, 2, 3,
bollocks.
There we go. So that'll get beeped or edited or whatever. Our listeners are very saintly and holy, so they will have no idea what that word even is. Neil, raise the tone, please.
Well, I thought mine was kind of cool, but yours was super edgy.
What's yours, Neil?
Mine was Franz Ferdinand's first album, which is Franz Ferdinand.
You're all seriously cool gentlemen, I have to say. Grand. Okay, now, a quick introduction to the second tune. Chris, do you want to do this again?
Sure.
As you wrote it?
Yeah, okay, so second tune is a bit more of a jazz kind of tune, but not conventionally jazz. But it's called It Gets Dark in Aberdeen Faster, and it was written last winter. Yeah, I got the train up from Edinburgh, and I don't know, by some stupidly early time, it was dark, and I couldn't see a thing on this wonderful train journey up the North Sea. Again, I wrote a tune shortly afterwards, and that came to mind.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is going to be, if we're ready, It Gets Dark in Aberdeen Faster. Thank you. Thank you so much, gents. That's Chris Hamer Trio with It Gets Dark in Aberdeen Faster. So at this point, we normally say, well, tell us about your website or your Twitter feed or your, you know, where we can get your albums. But that's not quite happened yet, I guess. But we'll happily punt this onto SoundCloud if you want to do that. We have a little place where that can go. Well, listen, thank you so much. As a big jazz fan myself, it's I've long wanted us to get some jazz into Small Voice. And I think what's lovely is that you've done that for us. But the Small Voice motif is always a little bit kind of laid back, hopefully with a bit of edginess in there somewhere. And I think that's probably what you've given us in that music. So thank you so much, the Chris Hamer Trio.
Thank you.
Cheers.
As ever, we finish with our moral mixdown. Now, this month exclusively, I'm offering you a little peek behind the curtain of Small Voice workings. You might not believe that we organise this in any way, but what tends to happen is, in the week running up to the podcast, we think, oh, blimey, we better think of something to discuss, and some obvious ones came out. And one of the things that was punted that we should discuss was the business of Black Friday, you know, the it's an American thing, isn't it, just after Thanksgiving, when a lot of the shops or online retailers have big discounts. And last year it went kind of crazy in Britain. There were scenes of people fighting each other in Asda. Other supermarkets are also available over big discounts. So we thought we might discuss that. And I then said online, sorry, not online. I then said in an email to the team, I think it's been a bit of a damn squib. And we thought we might not talk about it because there were no scenes, you know. There was no punch up in Asda. I think maybe Asda kind of dialed back. And then we got an email from Brian. Now, regular listeners may have heard us mention Brian before. Brian is our producer and a rather fine fellow he is too, a big brain head. I'd say he's got a big brain, but he's got big shoulders, so it's all quite proportional. If only we had a webcam.
Stop digging, Garrett,
I'm loving this because he can't speak. Anyway, he doesn't know what's coming. So I'm actually just going to read you. Brian sent an email, and we all jump when Brian sends emails. So he said, I said, Black Friday, shmidey, you know. But Brian said, there could be a lot of ethical things to talk about re-Black Friday. The rise of the e-society continues to the detriment of the we society. For the retailers, it wasn't a damp squib. He actually said damp squid, but I'll forgive him. For the retailers, it wasn't a damp squib. It moved from bricks and mortar to online. The online campaign against Black Friday may have worked. There were no crowds in the shop. Or it may not, because there was a massive increase online. And all of this further undermines city centre shops, which are the social and economic focal point for towns and cities and largest employers in all urban areas. That's the way that Brian speaks, by the way.
He does, yes.
And full disclosure, Anne is married to Brian, she knows well. And Brian finishes by saying, then the online shoppers will bemoan the boarded up shops. So Black Friday is a symptom of something bigger going on in society. So our shock, horror, big question this month: Black Friday is a symptom of something bigger going on in society. Our question is Brian right? That's it. We've finally got to that point. Obviously, he's always right. He is the producer. But Margaret, what do you think? Does he need to calm down a bit, or has he got, you know, do you think, is it a big thing? Was I wrong to call it a damp squid?
The Black Friday, well, I suppose there's a whole lot of different things to disentangle here, because Black Friday is not, I suppose the original intention was nothing to do with online shopping. It was all to do with going out and getting bargains and bringing in more money for not bringing in more money for the retailers, because the way it works in the UK, I understand, is that they have to cut the prices at the time when people would spend the money anyway, and it doesn't really do them any favours, which is perhaps why a lot of retailers opted out. But the whole online shopping business and the increase in online shopping, as opposed to actually going out in the street and trudging through the rain, snow and wind and all the rest of it to get your wonderful purchases, is, I think, a matter of concern. And I have thought in the past, certainly, that certain online retailers, and I won't mention any names, but you know where you can get anything you like and it arrives the next morning and
it rhymes with Blamazon.
Yeah, send it to a river in South America and there you are. But I actually would avoid shopping in that way, because it does some kind of damage, certainly to the people who make their living. If you kept to one bit, that would be perhaps all right.
It's kind of everything, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, well, for example, booksellers in particular, we've seen so many just giving up because the online branch has taken over.
But do we all have an e-device around this table? I think we do.
We do, yes.
I think we do. Uh-huh. So what people really want to know, of course, is does Anne think Brian's right?
I think he's both right and wrong.
Oh, very good.
Well, I recall an incident which I think is quite illuminating. I was working once in Arizona, and we had just arrived in Tucson at about 7 o'clock at night and had to go and find something to eat. So we said to one another, let's go down into the city centre and get something to eat. So we drove and we drove and we drove and we drove. And it was only after about 45 minutes that dawned on us there is no city centre in Tucson, Arizona, because if you want to buy anything, you have to go to a strip mall somewhere out on the periphery. So there was nowhere actually where people congregated, nowhere that people actually came together to do anything, whether that be shopping or going to concerts or just having a coffee with somebody in a cafe. There was no centre. Therefore, there was no sense of place. Therefore, you didn't really know who you were. I never quite tracked down, you know, where the people of Tucson got together, I would guess, other than churches. And so where does community exist? Where does it lie? Where is there interaction? What is it that's going to make us human in that sort of transactional way? And I do think that the move to online does move us in that direction. I was just thinking the other day, when you can buy things so cheaply, how is it possible for shops to go on paying the enormous rates that they pay for the real estate that they're built on? It's just not going to work as an equation. And I do think there's something to be lost, something that will make us less human when we shop only by the press of a button.
It's funny because I think you know, if you're housebound, the internet and the sort of things that you can now do from home, you know, I guess if you're elderly and you want to buy Christmas presents and so on, being able to do that online is quite amazing. And the rather weird thing is, of course, that in Britain, I mean, we just seem to be absolutely crazy for online. I don't have the stats to hand, I'm sorry, but I do know that even in America, online shopping is I think, not as big a deal as it is here. Certainly not home delivery. This idea of home delivery, I mean, okay, America's big, I guess, that's the problem. But certainly, mainland Europe look askance at us over the amount of time that we spend online buying stuff. Likewise, credit cards. My understanding is that most of mainland Europe think,
what would you want kind of wired up wrongly.
And it just seems to be this somewhat bizarre British thing. Although I think, and that's countered by memories of thinking of my parents and this idea that, you know, oh, you couldn't. The very idea of buying something on tech or something, you save up until
dodgy.
You got the money for it,
and then
you buy it. So, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, my approach to Blamazon, I must confess, is I like to think I'm urban gorilla because I have got a reading device courtesy. Let's call it a Mindle. And basically, I track books that I'm interested in. I do like to actually own a book. But if there's books I'm potentially interested in and, you know, I might want to read, but not the top of my wish list, then I keep an eye out for them on Amazon. When they come down to a really low price, I buy it. Now, in this way, I'm able to say that I am urban gorilla because Amazon's not getting much money from me. And, of course, I'm also able to be a tight-fisted Scot, which probably means that I'm not that much of an urban gorilla, and probably Blamazon are just laughing at me and saying, nah, we'll take your money. Interestingly, my brother, who used to buy a huge amount from Blamazon, sorry, I can't sustain this. He stopped. He just stopped, and he's now going to a chain of bookstores. I'll leave you to work out which one that is, given that I think Britain only has one, really.
Yes, yeah.
And he quite happily goes in and he orders the stuff there, and you know, he's paying a bit more for them, but he's come to kind of realise the value of having that bookstore. He enjoys going to a bookstore and browsing, and of course there's independence as well. I mean, let's be honest, independence look at the chain and kind of have a problem with them. But it's, mind you, I'm getting away from the Black Friday thing.
Mm-hmm. What interested me most about it was Buy Nothing Day.
Yes.
You know, I think for the first time you really saw, if we're still talking about online, you saw online and in social media a real reaction to Black Friday this time round in Britain. I mean, I believe it was still relatively successful in the United States where it originated.
But it is tight, yeah. Sorry.
But, you know, there just was this, no, enough. Enough of the consumerism, enough of the mad queuing from five in the morning to fight somebody for a 90-inch telly or whatever it is. We don't need it. And the whole idea of going for 24 hours without buying a single thing was people really subscribed to it. And, I mean, the shopping gene sort of bypassed me, so it's never been a big deal for me. But I was just very taken by the way that that really took off in social media this year.
One of the other things that I noticed, probably a little bit too late to do anything about it, though, was Giving Tuesday, which was something I saw from in one or two emails that I think one or two charities had picked this up. And one of the online giving websites was kind of punting this as well, that last Tuesday, 1st of December, there was marked down as Giving Tuesday. So maybe that'll catch on a bit next year. Yeah. Who knows?
You never know. It'd be nice to think that certainly the online is big business, it would seem, but at the same time, the rise of social media has allowed more kind of activism to come through, perhaps more successfully, because, I mean, you look at things like Twitter and Facebook, and to my knowledge, they're not yet actually making money, which is just the somewhat rather bizarre world that we live in. So, yeah, Giving Tuesday, why not? Give it a go. Well, there we go once again. It's time for our humble podcast to come to an end. We'll be back, Blimey O'Reilly, in the new year with the first Small Voice podcast of 2016. Soon be 8:30. But meantime, no, hold on, wait there. There's something I had to tell you, something important. What was it? No, hold on. Oh, I know. Merry Christmas when it comes.